Glenn Beck. The Blaze Radio Network.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt is often mentioned by historians as not just one of the greatest presidents in U.S. history, but the greatest president. These infatuated progressive scholars credit him with ending the Great Depression, his New Deal government programs, even though the Depression didn't end until American manufacturing finally kick-started the economy enough to negate the damage done by these massive government programs midway through World War II. These scholars also ignore FDR's internment of well over 100,000 Japanese Americans. Just as his progressive hero Woodrow Wilson had done with Germans and Italians during the First World War, simply because of their ancestry. Americans, like 4-year-old future Star Trek actor George Takei and his family.
I was 4 at the time of Pearl Harbor, and I was too young to really understand what was going on. But I still do remember that day when armed soldiers with guns, bayonets on them, came to our home to order us out. I remember that as a very scary day. And, you know, a child can sense your parents' anxieties. And we were taken from our home to a horse stable in at San Anita Racetrack, where we were housed for a few months while the camps were being built. And when the camp was built, we were put on a train and taken all the way across the southwestern desert to the swamps of Arkansas, a camp called Roller. And I grew up there for a portion of the war. And then we were transferred from that camp to another camp in Northern California called Tule Lake, which was an even more harsh camp. There were three levels of barbed wire fence and tanks patrolling the perimeter.
Most of those taken from their homes never got them back. The loss of liberty under FDR didn't stop there. For starters, there was Roosevelt's illegal wiretapping. Under cover of war, the president authorized agents to bug the phones of not just aliens who threaten national security, but potential political enemies and even political friends. An FDR biography documentary tells part of this story.
In his zeal to uncover acts of espionage, Roosevelt faces a problem. Congress has banned wiretapping, and the Supreme Court has ruled that wiretaps are inadmissible in a court of law. In May of 1940, Roosevelt chooses a course that, if discovered, could destroy his presidency. He writes a confidential memo to Attorney General Robert Jackson, instructing him to use listening devices to monitor people suspected of subversive activities. His rationale is that the court ruling does not apply in grave matters involving the defense of the nation.
Roosevelt's spying targets included former President Herbert Hoover, 1940 Republican presidential opponent Wendell Willkie, and critical journalists. FDR asked Treasury Secretary Morgenthau to run a tax audit on the New York Times, among the other IRS investigations FDR ordered on behalf of actual opponents. He also sicked the heads of various agencies, including the FBI and the Department of Justice, on several newspaper publishers in a failed witch hunt for evidence of Nazi ties. FDR's internment of almost 120,000 Japanese, most of whom were Americans, was particularly brazen. It violated the rights of habeas corpus, protection against search and seizure, and protection of property. But meanwhile, the Germans and Italians, the latter of whom consisted of 600,000 non-citizens, were never interned en masse. Roosevelt, however, was just following the progressive playbook, responding to his innate fear of people different from himself. Consistent with a progressive eugenicist who came before him and held disdain for inferior peoples, Roosevelt had historically argued that the Japanese immigrants were not able to assimilate on a biological basis. The Germans could be excused. Wilson had, after all, praised the Teutonic race, but not the Japanese. The distinction was made based purely on race. Roosevelt's irrational fear led to the rounding up and unjust imprisonment of tens of thousands of loyal Americans who happen to come from a different background. This is the price of progressive fear in high places. As World War II wound towards its end in 1944, FDR proposed a second Bill of Rights. The first one was apparently insufficient for him. So that year's State of the Union address, he argued, true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made.
A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education.
He may have originally claimed that all we have to fear was fear itself, but the reality was that he wanted Americans to fear a whole host of things, from Japanese Americans to those who didn't have enough to eat. Fear, after all, opened the door to all sorts of things that people wouldn't otherwise think possible. In addition to fear, Roosevelt appealed to the pride and patriotism. He noted that the nation must not be allowed to slide back into the 1920s normalcy. Were that to happen, he said, even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefields abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home. In other words, FDR argued that if Americans let his wartime reforms go away, they might as well have just lost the war in the first place. It sounds incredible, but it is a strategy employed by progressives in government over and over again. Legislation during a crisis lives on like a cockroach, able to survive even in the worst of conditions. It was a crisis, after all, that gave birth to the Patriot Act, a law that continues to be used to invade Americans' privacy long after September 11, 2001. In FDR's wartime America, rights were to be granted no longer by our creator, but the federal government. Security was now a trump to liberty. And if you disagreed with any of that, you were a Nazi, or at least someone who didn't care much about American values. Raymond Moley, a professor for Columbia and an economist, was a member of FDR's original brain trust that got him elected. He was a trusted presidential advisor and the author of most of FDR's first inaugural address. He was also a huge advocate for FDR's New Deal. But seeing its fruits, he quickly became disenchanted with those policies, even as early as 1933, even though he continued to write Roosevelt's speeches until 1936. Eventually, Moley broke completely with Roosevelt, and in his 1952 book, wrote,
"It was no secret that a great number of reformers in Roosevelt's bureaucracy were admirers of the great Soviet experiment. And some were secret agents of communism. In my opinion, there is a greater danger in collectivists than in the betrayal of our secrets to foreign powers. The danger lies in what can be done to a nation by public officials who do not believe in a free economy. In Roosevelt's day, there were many people working for the government who regarded his reforms as a mere prelude to revolution. America has been fortunate to avoid such a fate so far, but Roosevelt's revolution not only accomplished more than Wilson and the other progressives who came before him had ever dreamed possible, but it also set the stage for what was to come next. A New Deal and a second Bill of Rights were terrific starts, but what America really needed was someone who could pull all of the disparate pieces together someone who could appeal to all races and creeds and make Americans believe that they could achieve what no one before them had, that it was their duty to work towards something bigger than themselves, something he called a great society.
Roosevelt's call for progressive great society would be picked up and carried to the finish line by yet another American progressive. Two decades later, more on that in the next episode.
Want more serials? You can listen to every episode at glenbeck.com/serials. Next week, you'll learn about Lyndon B. Johnson and his failed Great Society, Project X, and Obama's vision for America.
Glenn Beck, The Blaze Radio Network.
Love Field, Dallas, Texas, November 22nd, 1963. Blood was everywhere. The dark red liquid stained his waking thoughts and haunted him when he closed his eyes. It decorated the leather interior of the limousine that sped towards Parkland Memorial. It was on the gurney that carried his shattered friend. And it was splattered over the pink dress of the dazed woman who stood beside him. It was a baptism by blood. Like the state he loved, Lyndon Baines Johnson was a large and imposing man. His head, his ears, his hands, even his voice, they all seemed to overwhelm those around him. Traits that helped him make deals with timid, cowering colleagues. But now, in the 2 hours since he first heard those loud pops, the new president of the United States tried his very best to be small. At 2:28 p.m., aboard a hot and crowded compartment on Air Force One, Johnson raised his massive right hand and placed the other on a Bible and swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. John F. Kennedy's casket laid next to him, the lifeless body having been rushed to the plane in a hearse within minutes of the president being declared dead. Amid tears, trauma, and blood, so much blood, the Kennedy era, what would soon be christened Camelot, had come to a violent end. Unlike others in the administration, it was fair to say that LBJ's love for his fallen leader was not total. It was hard for a man of destiny and greatness, as Johnson had long seen himself, to surrender his powerful Senate seat in order to play second fiddle to a young man from Harvard who'd probably never worked one hard day in his life. As vice president, LBJ was largely powerless, mostly marginalized. But he knew the Kennedy boys made fun of him. Jackie, who now stood humbly at his side, privately referred to him and his wife, Lady Bird, as Uncle Cornpone and his little pork chop. Her deceased husband hadn't been much kinder, once asking her rhetorically, "Oh, God, could you ever imagine what would happen to the country if Lyndon were president?" But there was no doubt. Lyndon needed them now. All of them. He needed Jackie, the family, the cabinet, even his nemesis, Bobby Kennedy. If he had any hope of leading the nation that didn't know him and leading the party that had chosen someone else just 3 years earlier, he needed them now. LBJ paced restlessly about the aircraft, avoiding eye contact with the grieving widow. He bit his oversized lower lip as he pondered the task before him. How could he claim the Kennedy mantle when, truth be told, he thought the Kennedy agenda was far too cautious and timid? He took his seat as the hulking aircraft taxied to the runway. Its four engines soon roared to life. And the plane shot forward and then up, as if on a trajectory of a rocket. He closed his eyes and relished the blackness. When he finally opened them a few minutes later, he peered out the window at the endless miles of fluffy clouds beneath him. 30 minutes into the flight, LBJ spoke with JFK's mother, Rose Kennedy, from Air Force One.
I wish to God there was something that I could do, and I wanted to tell you that we were greeting with you.
After the call, right there, at the top of the world, he decided that the Kennedy presidency would need to be remodeled. Fortunately, he wouldn't have to spend much time thinking about whom to model it on. His two idols, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. They had already created the template. Now Lyndon Baines Johnson just had to fill in the blanks. And after Kennedy's assassination, LBJ finally had the chance to live up to the legacy of his second daddy and make the spirit of Roosevelt proud. He had, quote, a specific objective in mind that guided his presidency from the start, end quote, one report noted, to outdo Franklin Roosevelt as the champion of everyday Americans. He would be the next generation's FDR. He would be what he called their daddy, whether they liked it or not. What Wilson had done to organize progressivism as a political force in the first place, and what FDR had done to build new progressive economic institutions during the crisis of the Great Depression and World War II, LBJ would now do by spreading progressivism into the mainstream at a time of similar tumult and disorder. And in doing so, he would set in motion the destructive forces of nihilism, hedonism, and blasphemy that marked the 1960s, a decade that would change America fundamentally forever. Johnson's presidency is primarily remembered for two things, both of them massive failures, the Vietnam War and the Great Society. Both exacted a horrific human toll on America. The war scarred an entire generation, and its consequences can be measured in lives lost or irreparably destroyed. The Great Society, however, left its mark on several generations, pushed America farther toward progressivism, and can only be measured in the lives that were ruined.
The Great Society asked not how much, but how good.
If how good was the question, the answer was not very. For progressives like Johnson, issues such as poverty, education, women's rights, and jobs are simply tools to be used in a continual effort to consolidate power and control. To understand how this works, we have to get into a bit of psychology. By stoking the fear of failure, disorder, and the unknown, progressives manipulate our most primal instincts. They hold out the collective or the herd as a solution to those fears and the way to alleviate our insecurities. Let's face it, solving our own problems is hard. Self-reliance takes work, pain, sacrifice, and oftentimes failure. Putting your trust in someone else to solve your problems is a whole lot easier. Scared of being poor? Don't be. Poverty can be solved. We just have to declare a war on it. Scared your kid isn't doing well in school? Well, it's probably not his or her fault. We just need to put more taxpayer money into the public education system. Scared about losing your job? Plenty more can be created if the rich would just pay their fair share. Women can achieve equality if only we provide them with government-subsidized contraceptives and health care. The environment can be saved if we would only enact sweeping regulations and new taxes that punish polluters. And the story goes on and on and on. Every problem has a big government solution. And these were cornerstones of the Great Society. LBJ's ultimate promise of hope and happiness to a fearful American public. Like Wilson and Roosevelt before him, Johnson had no qualms about sacrificing the rights and personal liberty of individuals at the altar of the state. The Great Society, much like Wilson's New Freedom and Roosevelt's New Deal, was meant to further transform American society and government from individualism to collectivism.
I propose that we begin a program in education to ensure every American child the fullest development of his mind and skills. I propose that we begin a massive attack on crippling and killing diseases. I I propose that we launch a national effort to make the American city a better and a more stimulating place to live.
Who could forget the Stimulating City Clause in the Constitution? The list of LBJ's great society proposals went on and on. In addition to fear-mongering, progressives also tend to be elitists and narcissists. LBJ had both of these traits in abundance. It takes an enormous amount of arrogance to believe that you and other chosen progressives know what is best for everyone else. Johnson was the epitome of this theory, both in terms of personal and political contradictions at his core and in the resources, ability, and unique moral force that he could deploy in its service in the wake of the JFK assassination. After enduring Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and LBJ, the nation had been very much transformed from its founding principles. Yet, there was still a lot more to come. More on that in the next episode.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
When America-changing social programs are mentioned, it usually is FDR who is mentioned for his New Deal program. But the president who perhaps deserves the most credit, or rather blame, is Lyndon Johnson. LBJ pushed a raft of new programs, all with FDR in mind. Cambridge University historian Anthony Badger, who wrote FDR, The First 100 Days, described LBJ's near obsession with FDR like this.
In April of 1965, he pressed his congressional liaison man, Larry O'Brien, to, quote, jerk out every damn little bill you can and get them down here by the 12th, because on the 12th, you'll have the best 100 days. Better than he did.
By at least one estimate, the JFK-LBJ administration added 390 domestic social programs to the federal government. Prior to their time in office, the entire federal government only had 45 such programs. The Great Society was the New Deal on steroids, the most destructive, anti-democratic, and anti-entrepreneurial program of the 20th century. Johnson's vision was utopian, statist, and reckless, as any rational observer would have concluded. But the grief of a nation reeling from an assassinated president, and the general sense that America was spiraling out of control, coupled with the fear of doing nothing, polluted rivers, impoverished cities, failing schools, and so on, spurred LBJ to act.
So, again, progressives would claim that their ultimate goal is the betterment of man through progress over time, improvements in education, more freedom from coercion by capitalist organizations and corporations and so on and so forth. What we've explored here, though, is that one of the key drivers for progressives is fear. So, again, there are these things out there that terrify them. They use those things also to terrify us, and then they present us with a solution to whatever that perceived threat is, that perceived problem. Here's the thing, though. If you actually look at progressivist policies applied to humanity, they're regressive. They don't actually create progress. You can take anything that you want. Take the war on poverty. You can take prohibition. Did any of those things actually result in the goal that it was trying to achieve? The war on poverty has just made more poor people. It's created a wider gap between the wealthy and the poor. It traps people in the very process of being in poverty. It doesn't allow them out of it.
Using these fears, he persuaded millions of Americans to abandon their traditional values of hard work and self-reliance in exchange for the soullessness of self-actualization. The message was simple. If you merely dream it, it will happen, and the Great Society will help you get there. As Johnson explained in May 1964 in a speech at the University of Michigan,
your imagination and your initiative and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our needs, are a society where old values and new visions are buried under unbridled growth.
For in your time, we have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society.
President Johnson continued.
The purpose of protecting the life of our nation and preserving the liberty of our citizens is to pursue the happiness of our people.
That pursuit no longer mattered if it was just one individual's happiness. Instead, the proper pursuit was now the happiness of our people, or the collective as a whole. That was our nation's calling.
The challenge of the next half century is whether we have the wisdom to use that wealth to enrich and elevate our national life.
Here's how we do it. The Great Society.
The Great Society is a place where every child can find knowledge to enrich his mind and to enlarge his talents. It is a place where leisure is a welcome chance to build and reflect, not a feared cause of boredom and restlessness. It is a place where the city of man serves not only the needs of the body and the demands of commerce, but the desire for beauty and the hunger for community. It is a place where man can renew contact with nature. It is a place which honors creation for its own sake and for what it adds to the understanding of the race. It is a place where men are more concerned with the quality of their goals than the quantity of their goods. But most of all, the Great Society is not a safe harbor, a resting place, a final objective, a finished work. It is a challenge constantly renewed, beckoning us toward a destiny where the meaning of our lives matches the marvelous products of our labor.
This was not a policy speech. It was a collectivist fantasy that could have been written by Karl Marx himself. Fittingly, the Great Society approach started with Johnson's disastrous war on poverty. In reality, it wasn't a war on poverty at all. It was a war against prosperity and success. Like all progressives, Johnson believed in economic leveling. Instead of lifting everyone up through commerce or capitalism, he wanted to force everyone into an economic purgatory where mediocrity was the norm and striving for greatness was discouraged. Like all progressive scams, the Great Society sought to convince marginalized groups, especially minorities, the poor, immigrants, and so on, that their relationships with the government should be redefined from JFK's
"Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country."
To the complete opposite. Had LBJ been as articulate as JFK, he could have easily framed the Great Society as, "Ask not what you can do for your country, ask what your country can do for you." LBJ pitched a simple deal to all those who felt aggrieved. The government would take away your fears and your hardships, and you, in turn, would devote your life, including your paychecks, to the state. In practice, the Great Society is an alphabet soup of government programs that cater to our every desire and complaint. If we want our children to be fed breakfast at school, there's a government program for that. We want more art in our public buildings or ballet in our theaters. There are government programs for those things, too. Here's a short list of just some of the measures passed under LBJ to show how all of his paternal care was translated into big government nonsense.
Anti-poverty programs such as the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, an Omnibus Housing Act, and the creation of Job Corps. Education programs such as Head Start, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and the creation of Volunteers in Service to America, VISTA. Sweeping healthcare reforms such as the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, the beginning of environmental controls through the Wilderness Protection Act and the Air and Water Quality Act, along with the creation of cultural patron programs such as the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities.
Under LBJ, the nation witnessed the true creation of the welfare state, based on massive entitlement programs and predicated on the government's ability to drive the populace to an ambition-destroying focus on inner meaning and quality of life instead of character, ambition, and success. This in turn created a crisis of conscience and confidence in people that made them both susceptible to undermining traditional norms and predisposed to reliance on the state to handle things that were too hard for them. LBJ laid the groundwork to create an environment of self-actualization through the government, conservation programs, federal patronage of the arts, and public broadcasting, just to name a few. These were not meant to foster national elevation or celebrate America's greatness. They were created as a corporate, secular replacement of religion as sources of spiritual fulfillment for the masses. Replace God with government, and you control not just people's minds, but their hearts and souls as well. Johnson's conclusion in his Ann Arbor speech that day in 1964 should be telling for anyone who wondered how the founders and their principles have become so marginalized over the last few decades.
So let us, from this moment, begin our work so that in the future men will look back and say, it was then, after a long and weary way, that man turned the exploits of his genius to the full enrichment of his life. Thank you. Goodbye.
This long and weary way he refers to is, of course, the previous centuries of American history. Centuries in which our forefathers built the greatest and most free country in the history of the world. This is what Johnson wished man to turn the exploits of his genius away from. It's no surprise that this speech by a gruff Texan reads like a self-help book. Johnson was more than just a daddy to the masses. He was also the father of a new, powerful cultural trend that gave people the excuse to be selfish. The me generation would have never existed if Johnson hadn't set out to specifically engender self-obsession. True freedom didn't come from hard work or any kind of traditional definition of professional achievement, such as becoming a doctor or a lawyer. True freedom, Johnson argued, could only be obtained by pursuing whatever you personally found fulfilling, whether other people found it useful or not.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Over the years, we've talked a lot about progressives like Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and LBJ. One we haven't discussed much is the man known as the Progressive Prophet, Stuart Chase. Chase was an American economist born in 1888. And influenced by the Fabian socialism and communist social and education experiments being conducted in the Soviet Union in the early 1930s. Progressives will tell you that at several points in his life, Stuart Chase was very critical of communists, as were many progressives, since progressivism applied is communism, and you get a chance to see the ugly results. But at the end of his 1932 book, A New Deal, from which FDR may have lifted the title for his social programs, Chase wrote, "Why should the Soviets have all the fun remaking a world?" He, like so many before him and after him, believed the world needed remaking in their own image. That is, a progressive, Fabian socialist image. So, where can we go? What sort of government and economic system should we adopt if constitutionalism and free market are passé? Good news. Chase sketched that out for us. There's just one problem. He couldn't come up with a name for it. Chase tossed around terms such as socialism, fascism, and state capitalism, but those didn't seem to fit the bill. And it's not hard to figure out why. The United States was at war with the fascists, of course, and like any good Fabian, he shied away from calling socialism by its name. State capitalism seemed closer to the mark, but it still wasn't quite right. So, Instead, he labeled America's future system, quote, something called X, end quote. This political system X, according to Chase, was already displacing the system of free enterprise all over the world. He offered a list of major characteristics of this new system. What's most striking, perhaps, about Chase's utopian vision is how much of it seems to have already come to pass in the United States. Let's take them one by one.
A strong centralized government.
We obviously have a strong centralized government that politicians of both parties have no compunction about expanding.
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
An executive arm growing at the expense of the legislative and judicial arms. In some countries, power is consolidated in a dictator issuing decrees.
This should be plainly obvious after the Obama administration's singular legacy of executive overreach.
We are not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing Americans the kind of help that they need. I've got a pen, and I've got a phone, and I can use that pen to sign executive orders and take executive actions.
The control of banking, credit, and security exchanges by the government.
Government continues to exert control of banking, credit, and security exchanges, and the recent Dodd-Frank legislation has only further cemented that.
The underwriting of employment by the government, either through armaments or public works.
The underwriting of Social Security and other social programs was realized as part of Johnson's Great Society, which Chase supported enthusiastically in his later life.
Will you join in the battle to build the Great Society, to prove that our material progress is only the foundation on which we will build a richer life of mind and spirit?
Unemployment remains a serious problem. Here, as in every other nation. And it is because of this that we've come to recognize the possibility and the necessity of certain helpful remedial measures. These measures are of two kinds. The first is to make provisions intended to relieve, to minimize, and to prevent future unemployment. The second is to establish measures, the practical means to help those who are unemployed in the present emergency. Our Social Security legislation is an attempt to answer the first of these questions, and our work relief program, the second.
The first thing we have to do is prevent the Republicans ever from privatizing it. They are still determined to privatize Social Security. You know, Harry remembers after Bush got reelected in 2004, the first thing he said was, let's go privatize Social Security. I was one of the leaders in the Senate with Harry and others. We went around the country. We made it clear we would never let that happen.
Right. At $23 trillion of unfunded liability, you certainly wouldn't want to privatize. But Chase's progressive vision continued.
The underwriting of food, housing, and medical care by the government. The United States is already experimenting with providing these essentials. Other nations are far along the road.
The underwriting of food, housing, and medical care is evident in First Lady Michelle Obama's signature issue, the federal intervention into what local school districts feed their children.
Barack knows that we are going to have to make sacrifices. We are going to have to change our conversation. We're going to have to change our traditions, our history. We're going to have to move into a different place as a nation.
No doubt Americans couldn't have imagined that change would even include the way they allow us to eat.
Starting this year, the talented people who cook the food at your school will be offering you all kinds of healthy, delicious new choices.
Those choices have been so delicious that the students at schools have rebelled against the program, some demanding a way out. But back to Stuart Chase's utopian vision of a coming America. The prediction of government underwriting medical care has come true with a vengeance in the age of Obamacare.
We go through the gate's closed, we'll go over the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security.
The use of deficit spending technique to finance these underwritings. The annually balanced budget has lost its old-time sanctity.
How about that use of deficit spending technique to finance these underwritings? Not even Chase could have conceived a federal deficit of more than $500 billion, as is predicted for fiscal year 2017. Democratic and Republican politicians seem to agree with Chase's assessment that the quaint notion of a balanced budget has lost its old-time sanctity.
Back then, our debt was around $16 trillion. Now it's approaching about $20 trillion.
The abandonment of gold in favor of managed currencies.
We achieved the abandonment of gold in favor of managed currencies under a Republican president when Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971.
I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connolly to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
The control of natural resources, with increasing emphasis on self-sufficiency.
Clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American. To guarantee that birthright, we must act, and act decisively. It is literally now or never.
The control of energy sources, hydroelectric power, coal, petroleum, natural gas.
And guess what this liberal would be all about? This liberal will be all about socializing, would be about basically taking over and the government running all of your companies.
And Barack Obama boldly warned what would happen if he were president to the energy sources he didn't care for.
If somebody wants to build a coal power plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they're going to be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas that's being emitted.
President Obama also nearly single-handedly shut down the proposed Keystone Pipeline.
The State Department has decided that the Keystone XL Pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States.
The control of transportation, railway, highway, airway, waterway.
Between the FAA, the Department of Transportation, which includes maritime and waterways, the Federal Highway Administration, the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, or Amtrak, which is partially owned and subsidized by the government, Amtrak today holds a monopoly on passenger rail transportation in the United States. Control of transportation by the federal government really is complete. Chase also proposed
the control of agricultural production, the control of labor organizations, often to the point of prohibiting strikes, the state control of communications and propaganda.
And when he did, he mentioned the FCC, which of course is still in operation today, and arguably even more powerful. With the exceptions of full control of agriculture and labor unions, virtually everything Stuart Chase foresaw that would lead to his progressive utopia through System X in the United States has been achieved. It's pretty remarkable how well someone writing in 1942 predicted the current state of the American government and economy. But it is less remarkable when you think about the gradualism, the progressivism that is so essential to the Fabian socialism Chase embraced first, and progressivism he adopted later. The ends justify the means. He knew the revolution would not be achieved with one shock to the system or international crisis. He knew it had to take place over time, year after year, wave after wave. It had to seem organic, as if it was something that the American people themselves desired. He knew that if progressives stuck around long enough, they would eventually triumph. While Chase was certainly a visionary, his vision, at least that which he published, was incomplete. With Political System X, he captured a central part of the grand progressive plan. Next time, those who are trying to put the finishing touches on the Stuart Chase grand vision.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is a guy who lives in my neighborhood, who's a professor of English, who engaged in detestable acts 40 years ago when I was 8 years old.
Ayers has never repented and has said as late as 2001 he wished he had done more to stop the war. But the relationship between Obama and Ayers went much deeper, ran much longer, and was much more political than Obama said.
Chicago, Illinois, July 1995. The future president of the United States stood in the living room of a domestic terrorist. They were in Hyde Park, a Chicago neighborhood of tree-lined streets dotted with handsome old stones and brick houses. In this highly segregated city, Hyde Park stands out as a vibrant, racially diverse, but monolithically leftist melting pot. There couldn't be a more fitting place for a future commander-in-chief to live, just mere blocks away from former domestic terrorist, not to mention Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan. Hyde Park is the home to the prestigious University of Chicago, but venture just a few blocks outside the neighborhood and you'll find yourself in the middle of Chicago's notorious South Side. The ivory tower of elitist academics looms over crippled communities riddled with drugs, gangs, and broken homes. The slums and Section 8 housing projects are home to some of the highest murder rates in the civilized world. The wreckage caused by decades of leftist rule, ironically, lies all around the progressive Hyde Park citizens, although they refuse to acknowledge it, let alone take any responsibility for it. "Barry, if I have one lesson for you," Bill Ayers said, "it's this. If you really want to change things, you've got to drop the radical pose for the radical ends. You're a talented community organizer. Politics is just community organizing on a larger scale. People project their hopes, their dreams, and their aspirations on you. They don't expect you to actually solve their problems, but they want you to say you'll try." End quote. Barack Obama, a 34-year-old aspiring politician, listened to Bill Ayers intently. "What matters more than what you say," Ayers continued, "is how you say it. You can play on fear, but ultimately, you have to give people the antidote. And the antidote is hope. We lost a generation of progress because we didn't understand that simple rule." Obama grinned as he put out his cigarette, anticipating the arrival of his wife, Michelle, and Ayers' wife, Bernadine Dorn, as well as many other guests whom he would attempt to dazzle out of their money that night. The duo of Ayers and Dorn was nothing if not dynamic. The two had spent almost 11 years on the run, fugitives from the law. In fact, Dorn had achieved the distinction of making the FBI's 10 most wanted list. All the more impressive, considering that only 9 women have ever been listed there. What was it they were running from? Ayers, Dorn, and their Weather Underground co-conspirators had sought to spark a full-on communist revolution in the 1960s and 70s by destroying property and killing those who got in their way. After the two grew tired of running and finally turned themselves into authorities, only Dorn faced charges, and they were minor. Blessed with unexpected freedom, the two revolutionaries continued to adhere to their belief, never expressing remorse for their crimes. Dorn eventually landed at the prominent law firm Sidley Austin, the same firm where Barack would later meet Michelle. And she later served as a professor of law at Northwestern University. Ayers reinvented himself as a professor of education at the University of Illinois, where he got to shape young minds on a daily basis, and this time without explosives. As they finished their conversation, Obama, ever the shrewd politician, asked one last question. Quote, "What do I tell people if they ask about our relationship?" End quote. Ayers displayed his characteristic mischievous smirk. "Just tell them, I am a guy who lived in your neighborhood," end quote. He then turned and opened the front door to a stream of prospective Obama donors. As it turned out, it was the opening of a door that would one day lead to the door of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Having spent his entire life with and around radicals and revolutionaries, like his parents, anti-American communist poet and mentor Frank Marshall Davis, his pastor Jeremiah Wright, Bill Ayers, and of course, during his college years,
"To avoid being mistaken for such a sellout, I chose my friends carefully. The more politically active black students, the foreign students, the Chicanos, the Marxist professors and structural feminists and punk rock performance poets."
Marinating in a radical progressive or communist brew like that, you might expect an openly Marxist rhetoric coming from Barack Obama. But he was smart enough to understand that it wouldn't play well with the American people. While a non-politician progressive, such as influential historian Howard Zinn, for example, will say that America's experiment has been immoral, Obama will rephrase that to say that the mistreatment of Native Americans and our original sin of slavery indicate that we must not have always lived up to our values and that we must still be better.
"I think we can say that the Constitution reflected a enormous blind spot in this culture that carries on until this day, and that the framers had that same blind spot. I don't think the two views are contradictory to say that it was a remarkable political document that paved the way for where we are now, and to say that it also reflected the fundamental flaw of this country that continues to this day."
Obama may not overtly attack the rich, but he will argue that they ought to pay their fair share and that at some point people have earned enough.
We're not trying to push financial reform because we begrudge success that's fairly earned. I mean, I do think at a certain point you've made enough money."
He will not exhibit blatant hostility towards private business, but he will admit that he sides with labor and that regulations can help strengthen the economy while protecting the environment.
"I spent my entire adult life working with SEIU. I'm not a newcomer to this."
He won't claim that America is a racist nation, but he will say that there are issues of race that still haven't been overcome and that minorities continue to have legitimate grievances.
"All of us as Americans should be troubled by these shootings, because these are not isolated incidents. They're symptomatic of a broader set of racial disparities that exist in our criminal justice system."
He will not explicitly say that his framework is dialectical, that is, based on the Marxist vision of looking at the world through a prism of competing races, classes, and sexes, such as the oppressors versus the oppressed, victimizer versus the victim. But he will admit to standing with the powerless. In Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, almost every argument is presented as follows. Conservatives believe X, liberals believe Y. While both sides have legitimate concerns, we should respect conservatives for their beliefs. I stand with the liberals. While Obama is quick to praise the free market, such praise is almost always followed with but. During a 2005 address, he said, quote, "Our greatness as a nation has depended on a belief in the free market, but it has also depended on our sense of mutual regard for each other, the idea that everyone has a stake in the country, that we're all in this together." He also famously said,
"It's not that I want to punish your success. I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance at success too. I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody."
So again, he doesn't want to punish your success, but there's that word when there really shouldn't be one. I love the Constitution, but as he would later argue in a speech in Kansas, the very city where Teddy Roosevelt had delivered his famous New Nationalism address a century earlier, but we simply can't return to this brand of you're on your own economics if you're serious about rebuilding the middle class in this country, end quote. To each of the progressives we've discussed in the past 3 weeks, the Constitution is great. But it's old. It's outdated. They couldn't have foreseen the progress that we've made and need to continue to make. Now that we've spelled out who progressives are and how and why they are who they are, what to do about it? Or as Bill Ayers would say, where's the hope? In my new book, Liars, find out the cure to progressivism.
Want more serials? You can listen to every episode at glennbeck.com/serials. Next week, you'll learn about Hillary Clinton's hero, Saul Alinsky.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.